then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, O O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. Roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's March the 8th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, first a quick housekeeping note. For the past couple of months, our listenership and my incoming email response has been dropping off, and that's par for the course. For some reason, which I've never entirely understood, the movement is a seasonal thing, a phenomenon I've discussed before on here, and we're just now coming out of what we call winter doldrums, which is a period from about the second week in January to the second week in March, where everyone wanders off and hides in a hole, and they hang their heads down and moan and groan because it's so cold and gray and nasty and depressing, and the Christmas bills are coming due, yada yada yada, and they just can't be bothered with anything except self-pity and television. The other bad period is called summer slump. That's July and August. Major Gadke once told me that movement actives might as well just hang up a sign and go fishing in July and August because nobody's interested. Anyway, about this time of year, participation always starts to pick up, and this year is no different. This means that, once again, I'm now receiving approximately 200 non-spam emails per day, in addition to all the other things I have to deal with. Now, don't get me wrong at all, guys. I'm not complaining about this. It's a good thing that I should be so busy. But it does kind of slow down the speed and quality of my own response. What I want you all to understand is that if you do send me an email demanding some kind of lengthy and considered response, the fact is you may be waiting for a while, or else you may get simply a kind of monosyllabic grunt in response just to acknowledge the email, which makes a lot of people think I'm being rude and I don't have time for the rank and file, so to speak. Now, that is not my intention at all. Without you folks' support, I could never have published a single word over the past decades. Not to mention that I'd be living under a bridge. Please don't believe that I ever forget that fact. I don't, and I'm deeply grateful to all of you. But you folks, on your part, are going to have to realize that as part of my growing level of success in communicating the Northwest ideal, my time is in fact becoming something that I have to manage better. There, is that diplomatic enough? On the upside, I now, at long last, have at least a part-time assistant. And this person has already taken a great deal of the burden off my shoulders in the past couple of weeks in the form of helping me get the last Northwest Observer out and dealing with our end-of-the-month jam. Now, that's the last week in every month when we have three major events that crash in on us here. The production and mailing of Northwest Observer, a monthly unit meeting, and of course, that week's Radio Free Northwest. I hope very much that this new assistant will be able to kind of deputize for me soon on fielding some of these emails. Now, having explained that I really don't want to sound rude, I will now proceed to sound rude. I know it's incredibly annoying to expect some kind of long, deep, and soul-searching colloquy with the top man himself and get fobbed off by being told to go to a website or, worse yet, take the time to purchase and sit down and read a book. However, in point of fact, virtually all legitimate questions about the Northwest Migration and the Northwest Independence Movement have already been answered either in my 5 Northwest Independence novels or else in the 4th edition of the Northwest Migration Manual, otherwise known as the White Book. Could you guys do me a favor, please, that would save everybody a lot of time? Could you please not ask me any really heavy questions about the NF or the Northwest Imperative until you've actually read my books on the subject? Because, I repeat, I can't remember the last time I got a serious question that was not answered somewhere in the 5 novels or in the White Book or on one of our websites. The White Book especially is designed for one purpose and one purpose only, to answer your questions. I'm finding it increasingly frustrating, not to say time-consuming, to be confronted with demands that I personally produce and tailor long, detailed, in-depth, personalized individual answers to questions that have already been answered long ago in my books or elsewhere, at greater length and with far better precision than I could tap out in an individual email.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally. Can you think of anything you have a really hard time throwing away? For me, it's food. In my fridge, you can find little tiny containers of 1-ounce portions of meat that are labeled and dated. I can't stand to throw away even a few bites of food. Which is why I found it especially disturbing when a comrade forwarded me an article about a farm family who was ordered by the health department to throw away hundreds of pounds of food that was meant to be served to guests in a family-style picnic on what is known as Quail Hollow Farm in Overton, Nevada. The farm couple, Monty and Laura Bledsoe, put together a dinner party for several guests and planned many courses of homegrown and prepared organic food. 2 days before the picnic, the health department called them and informed them that because this was considered a public event, they would have to apply for a special permit or pay a ridiculous fine. They applied for the permit, but then were told they would not be issued the permit until a health inspector came out to look at the farm. The inspector showed up as the guests were arriving, then told the couple the food was unfit for consumption due to things like not having labels and receipts on the food, which was all grown and produced on their farm and did not come in a package from the store. Monty and Laura thought they saw a loophole and decided to allow all the guests to join their farm club, which would change the event from public to private, and then the health inspector would have had to leave. The inspector responded by threatening to call the police and said the only way the couple could keep the guests on their property was to destroy the food. They asked the inspector if they could save the food for their own family, and this request was denied because it would supposedly endanger their family's health. They asked if they could instead feed it to their pigs, and were again told if they did not destroy the food and also pour bleach on it, they would face police action. So, regrettably, the couple complied and then later sought the services of what is known as the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. The fact that such a fund has been set up out of necessity is a shame. The health inspector's name is Mary Oakes. She looks like she's about 65 years old, with these nasty hanging jowls and meth mouth, one of those women who probably hasn't been laid ever since her uncle lost interest in her and wakes up pathetically trying to put herself together and go to her job at the Southern Nevada Health District in Las Vegas. Information about her salary was available for anyone to look up. This sack of crap only makes $57,000 a year for raiding farms and ruining dinners. What a pathetic bitch. I make a lot more than that just with my Axis Sally job. If I may speak personally to Monty and Laura, who are white as far as I can tell, let me say, this is partly your fault. You agreed to their demands in the first place. You let that nasty old bag health inspector on your property. You listened to her and you did everything she said because she threatened to call the big bad police on you. You don't need permission to have a little party with your friends on your land. You are all adults and you can eat whatever the hell you want. And of course, someone is circulating an online petition. Online petitions aren't nearly as effective as bullets, badges, and hypodermics filled with bleach. I really think this is one area where niggers have the right idea. When they don't know what to do, which is usually every day, they just start rioting. Just start breaking stuff, even if it's your own stuff, and hope that somehow gets your point across. So, listeners, if this happens to you, and it may if you have potlucks or grow a vegetable garden or really go to the extreme with a lemonade stand, don't give in. Don't apply for their permits. Don't let them onto your land. If they barge in, do what any normal white person would do to a trespasser. Take your patio furniture and your lawn chairs and dinner plates and start breaking them. The authorities won't know how to respond to this. Take your food and defiantly shove it in your face. If they threaten to call the police, let them. Cops love it when they get interrupted by other government agencies and are told that there is a farm where people are eating. If the cops actually do show up, all of the food will have been eaten, and then what are they going to do? Arrest every single one of you and your guests? Where will they take you? How many additional units will need to be brought in? How much money will this cost the city? How much paperwork will need to be done about food that wasn't even there by the time the cops arrived? How will they prove who ate what forbidden food? I think the Bledsoes could use a copy of the White Book, some Northwest Front stickers, and more information about us that describes our vision. A land where families are allowed to feed their own and no one will call the cops on you because your lamb meatballs don't have a label on them. Oh, and also, no niggers and kikes. Monty and Laura, if you're listening, and I assume you are, I hope you stop by the Seattle Area Northwest Front Unit. Come spend the day with us. We'll show you all around the area, maybe invite you to the studio to be guests on our show, and then a few of us will make you one of our traditional welcoming dinners. I warn you, some of this food isn't certified and the kitchens aren't licensed, but I hear you guys are into stuff like that. But let's not forget the other unfortunates. We can easily find Mary Oak's address by looking up the health department office. First of all, we need to send her some bleach so she can disinfect her bodily orifices, if they haven't been crusted over from disuse. Then you might want to send her some beauty products, any old leftover shampoo, hand lotion, hell, even counter cleaner might do her some good. Then throw in some old dentures you find lying around somewhere. Because that's what I'm all about, eating food and helping people. Now, on a personal note, I know it hasn't been quite a year that I've been gracing you with my presence, but what a great almost year it's been. When Harold first suggested I do this show, I thought it was the dumbest idea he'd ever had. I thought, who the hell wants to listen to me read about National Socialism or whatever? As it turns out, everyone does. I am one of those people who just plain do not like to talk, even though people have told me ever since I was a little kid that I should become a radio announcer because I had an interesting voice. Well, if you insist. I'm sure this isn't what they had in mind, but they didn't specifically tell me not to join some white supremacy thing. But seriously, one time I had laryngitis and literally could not make a vocal sound for an entire week. I was worried how this would affect my work performance at my regular job. As it turns out, no one noticed. Another time, I lost my phone for a week. When I found it, I saw that no one had called. This should demonstrate how little I actually say in real life. I never imagined that speaking on this show for a few minutes every week would generate so much mail that I scarcely have time to read it all. Well before I could post my standard "I don't do Valentine's Day" message, I was bombarded with cards and little gifts and lots of food. I may have to revise that stance after all. Anyway, many thanks, guys. This has all been great fun, and I look forward to seeing how the next year plays out.
Now, another thing has come up. Now, you may recall that last summer, Radio Free Northwest started getting nasty letters from the FCC demanding that we include diverse community programming and so forth in our weekly podcasts. And rather than go round and round with them and respond to their requests for filings and hearings and appeals and so on, I went ahead and I went down to the bus station. I found this old nigger wino named Dry Ice Washington, and every now and then I give him a jug of Carlo Rossi to come on the show and mutter for a few minutes, and that counts as our minority community access. Well, now they're at it again, only this time the FCC is demanding that we run community-oriented public service announcements. And once again, having looked over all the forms I would have to fill out and having to go for hearings and this kind of BS, as annoying and distracting as this is, I still think it's best to give these asshole bureaucrats what they want. That may not be fiery revolutionary principle, but I'm sorry, out here in the real world, sometimes you have to take the line of least resistance. So in compliance with this latest FCC diktat, here is our public service announcement for the week.
Doesn't it? Lots of young people hitchhike seems like a good way to get from one place to another. But sometimes there are dangers involved that never meet the eye. So no matter where you meet a stranger, be careful if they are too friendly. One never knows when the homosexual is about. Let's take the case of Jimmy Barnes. Jimmy played baseball all afternoon, and he didn't feel like walking home, so he decided to thumb a ride. He'd done it 100 times before, and he didn't think anything was unusual when the driver struck up a friendly conversation. In fact, he seemed like a real nice guy. What Jimmy didn't know was that Ralph was sick, a sickness that was not visible like smallpox, but no less dangerous and contagious, a sickness of the mind. You see, Ralph was a homosexual, a person who demands an intimate relationship with members of their own sex. So no matter where you meet a stranger, be careful if they are too friendly, if they try to win your confidence too quickly, and if they become overly personal. One never knows when the homosexual is about. He may appear normal.
"15,000 snitches. That's a lot of snitches. But that's what our lords and masters apparently feel is required to spy on Americans and make sure that we don't think impure thoughts. Now, last week, there were a number of media reports all over the web and cable news as follows. I quote this one from RT.com. The Federal Bureau of Investigation employs upwards of 15,000 undercover agents today, 10 times what they had on the roster back in 1975. By the by, if I could interject here, almost none of these rats are actual badge-carrying agents. Now, this is not some Tom Cruise movie, and it's not 24, where some handsome but tormented red, white, and blue hero takes on the evil, dark-skinned Muslims who are planning on some horrible terrorist act here in the United States. That is the self-image of these secret police bastards. The reality is grubby and squalid and cowardly. Your average FBI snitch looks nothing like Tom Cruise or Kiefer Sutherland. He looks like Smeagol from The Lord of the Rings. For that matter, so do most of the agents, once you get past the $1,500 suits and look at their souls. Now, most of these hirelings are civilian informers who are paid piecework rates by the conviction, which kind of motivates them to, how can I put this, enhance their information and courtroom testimony. Now, the media article goes on, quote, if you think that's a few spies too many, spies earning as much as $100,000 per assignment, one doesn't have to go too deep into their track record to see their accomplishments. Those agents are responsible for an overwhelming amount of terrorist stings that have stopped major domestic catastrophes in the vein of 9/11 from happening on American soil. Ah, but let me ask you something. How many of these terrorist stings are in fact genuine? And how many are hoaxes fabricated by the snitches for money and the FBI itself for a budget and little gold stars on their foreheads from Obama? Back to the article. Another thing those agents are responsible for, however, is plotting those very schemes. The FBI has in recent years used trained informants not just to snitch on suspected terrorists, but to set them up from the get-go. A recent report put together by Mother Jones, which, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is a left-wing radical magazine, and the investigative reporting program at the University of California, Berkeley, which I think we can assume is another bunch of lefties, analyzes some striking statistics about the role of FBI informants in terrorism cases that the Bureau has targeted in the decades since the September 11th attacks. The report reveals that the FBI regularly infiltrates communities, which could mean anything, where they suspect terrorist-minded individuals to be engaging with others. Regardless of their intentions, agents are sent in to converse within the community to find suspects who could potentially carry out lone wolf attacks and then, more or less, encourage them to do so. By providing weaponry, funds, and a plan, FBI-directed agents will encourage otherwise unwilling participants to plot out terrorist attacks, only to bust them before any events fully materialize. Why does the name Oklahoma City keep popping into my mind when I read this? You'd think that they would have learned their lesson back in Oklahoma City when one of their little stings went wrong and the military-trained Tim McVeigh actually constructed a detonator that worked and John Doe number 2 bailed far earlier than he should have because he's a fucking coward and McVeigh went ahead and carried out the mission. But I guess the FBI is, in their way, just as incapable of learning from the past as we are. Ever since Dr. Pierce wrote Hunter, we have all wondered how the secret police would deal with the threat of lone wolf attacks, if and when they ever materialized. Now, in point of fact, none of them have. It seems that white people just don't produce that kind of man anymore, with the possible exception of McVeigh. But now we know what the system is doing about it. They're profiling and picking somebody they think might be a lone wolf and then setting up the whole thing from beginning to end so they can get their little gold stars on their foreheads from Obama. That poor dumb camel jockey who was arrested near the Capitol in Washington, D.C. about a month ago thought he was a member of an Al-Qaeda cell of about six men, and it turned out that every single one of them except him was an FBI informer. Of course, all these quote-unquote prevented attacks get the Bureau a lot of good ink, or in this day and age, a lot of good bandwidth. Back to the RT.com article. Additionally, one former high-level FBI official speaking to Mother Jones says that for every informant officially employed by the Bureau, up to three unofficial agents are working undercover. The FBI has used these informants to set up and thus shut down several of the more high-profile would-be attacks in recent years. The report reveals that the Washington, D.C. Metro bombing plot, the New York City subway plot, the attempt to blow up Chicago's Sears Tower, and dozens more were all orchestrated by FBI agents. In fact, reads the report, only three of the more well-known terror plots of the last decade weren't orchestrated by FBI-involved agents. The report reveals that in many of the stings, important meetings between informants and the unknowing participants are left purposely unrecorded in order to avoid any entrapment charges that would cause the case to be dismissed. Perhaps the most high profile of the FBI proposed plots was the case of the Newburgh Four. Around an hour outside of New York City, an informant infiltrated a Muslim community and engaged four local men to carry out a series of attacks. These men may never have actually carried out an attack, but once the informant offered them a plot and a pair of missiles, they agreed. Defense attorneys cried entrapment, but the men still were sentenced to 25 years apiece. Again, why does the name Edgar Steele keep floating around in my mind when I read this stuff? Okay, the unspoken covenant or gentleman's agreement or whatever regarding these activities is that all of these tactics will only be used by the FBI and the government against dark-skinned Muslims and foreigners. The trouble is that no one seems to have told the government about this alleged understanding we think we have. What about the Matt Hale case? The Huttery Militia case? The abominable case of Edgar Steele, where audio recordings were forged by FBI technical experts and other experts who were prepared to testify to the fact that the tapes were forged, were excluded from the courtroom by the judge, and the jury was never allowed to hear their evidence. 60,000 snitches all told. Exactly how much money is being spent every year in spying on and entrapping Americans? Recently, self-identified FBI informer Brian Holland stated in a media interview that he had received about $8,000 per month to spy on pro-white groups for 11 years and never achieved even a single conviction or legal charge. Hey, maybe some of the more paranoid among us are right. Maybe the FBI does have microphones in the sugar bowl. Those 60,000 snitches have to be working on something. Okay, first music break. We haven't had much Revolutionary War music on here, so here's a song about a group of guerrilla fighters who fought against tyranny with weapons in their hands. They were called the Green Mountain Boys. And when you look at their record, you understand why the present regime isn't too keen for that part of our history to be remembered.
Vermonters, hunters, come down with your breeches of deerskin and jackets of brown, with your red woolen caps and your moccasins. Come to the gathering summons of trumpet and drum. Come down with your rifle, let gray wolf and fox howl on in the shadow of primitive rocks. Let bare feet securely from pig pen and stall. Here's two-legged game for your powder and ball. And cheer, cheer, the Green Mountaineer. And cheer, cheer, the Green Mountaineer. On the south came the Hessians, our land to police, and armed for the battle while canting of peace. On our east came the British, the red-coated band, to hang up our leaders and eat up our land. Oh, all to the rescue, for Satan shall work no gain for the legions of Hampshire and York. They claim our possession, the pitiful knaves. The tribute we pay shall be prisons and graves. Then cheer, cheer, the Green Mountaineer. Then cheer, cheer, the Green Mountaineer. We owe no allegiance, we bow to no throne. Our ruler is law, and the law is our own. Our leaders themselves are our own fellow men, who can handle the sword and the scythe and the pen. Hurrah for Vermont, for the land that we till must have sons to defend her from valley and hill. Our vow is recorded, our banner unfurled. In the name of Vermont we defy all the world. Then cheer, cheer, the Green Mountaineer. Then cheer, cheer, the Green Mountaineer. Then cheer, cheer, the Green Mountaineer.
A couple of days ago, the Obama regime announced that as part of Obamacare, this big, huge medical octopus that's going to be taking over American health care in 2014, religious groups of all kinds, hospitals, charities, insurance programs, anything that has to do with the church, Catholic Church, Southern Baptist, anybody, anything that they do that has to do with medicine or healthcare must provide a full range of so-called women's services, which includes abortion, abortion counseling, the morning after abortion pill, and all forms of contraception, regardless of their religious beliefs against such practices. This, of course, is a direct slap, first off, at the Catholic Church, but also at a lot of these other denominations, such as the Southern Baptists, who do get involved in many ways in healthcare through financing hospitals and clinics and whatnot. But because of their religious objections, they do not provide information on abortion or contraception. So far, no one has had the sheer, what the Jews call, chutzpah, to insist that these outfits provide this information. But of course, then along came Obama. It's, I think, pretty typical. Not only are the liberal Democrats and the politically correct system determined to force abortion and contraception and all kinds of sexual perversion in general down the throats of all Americans, but they intend to make people who don't support these things, religious people, Christians, right-wingers, conservatives, whoever, they're going to make us pay for it, which is, of course, the pure mark of the liberal Democrat. They not only demand to enforce all this stuff on Americans, but they insist that we pay for it.
Right. And I remember talking about this a couple of podcasts ago. I mentioned an article where I read this was going to be pretty much required for all health insurance providers within just the state of Washington. But now it looks like with Obamacare, it's going to be a federal thing.
Yeah, this is what people like Rush Limbaugh and others warned about back a couple of years ago when this thing was pending in Congress. What is being created here through Obamacare is a gigantic medical monster. It will take over not only all of American health care, which is roughly equivalent to 1/6 of the entire economy, but it will take over almost every aspect of Americans' lives, because health care or medical matters give the government so many windows of entrance into people's lives, financial, personal, religious. Almost anything that the government wants to interfere in, they can use healthcare as a wedge. For example, your personal lifestyle, whether you want to smoke or eat meat or whatever like that, they can say, well, you can't do that because your healthcare is now being paid for by the taxpayer and that's too expensive. So you can't engage in all these various practices that might end up costing the taxpayer money, so forth and so on. So this is one of the first fruits of Obamacare. And so far, one Southern Baptist leader has vowed and sworn that he's going to go to jail rather than comply with this. Yeah, I'll believe that when I see it. I don't think any of these people have the stones to go to jail.
Well, another thing that this ties into directly is this regime, like most liberals do, they believe they know better than everyone else, and therefore that entitles them to tell everyone else and mandate to everyone else what they can and cannot do, what they can and cannot think, what they can and cannot believe. And interfering with the spirituality of people, of any people, anywhere, really, is a real problem. And it bothers me because even though, as I'm sure most of the audience already knows, being a pagan, one thing I gotta say is the Catholic Church and other spiritualities did preserve a lot of traditional European holidays. Everyone gets mad about the War of Christmas. Why is that? It's because it's something that's part of our culture. Well, they're taking away the culture. Now they want to take away the morals behind the religion, not killing infants. A lot of people in this nation feel very strongly about that, but now they're interjecting themselves, saying that they know better and that everyone else is just going to have to follow through. Without disregard, how long is it going to be until they simply say you can't have a religion anymore?
Well, you can have a religion, but it has to be the approved religion. You know, there are government-approved forms of Christianity with women priests and homo priests and versions of the Bible that kind of forget about the biblical injunction against, you know, buggery and homosexuality. And my personal theory is a lot of this hatred of Catholicism has to do with the enmity that the organized homosexual lobbies have against the last conservative bastion, if you will, against their lifestyle and their filthy practices. I'm sure that if the Catholic Church would kind of unbend their theology and backtrack a little bit on things like, you know, ordaining women and men fucking each other in the ass and this sort of stuff, I'm sure that a lot of this anti-Catholic crap would go away. One of the things that the government wants to do is they want to control every aspect of people's lives, and that includes whether or not you have children to begin with, and also how you raise the children. I think this is one of the things that got the government really pissed off at Edgar Steele. About 10 years ago, he defended a couple named Christine who actually kidnapped their own children back from Child Protective Services in Oregon, and the terrible act of child abuse that the Christines were committing against their kids, allegedly, was raising them as vegetarians. And so basically, their kids were fairly thin, which is what's going to happen if you eat an all-vegetable diet, but they weren't typical American fat kids who were gorging on Slurpees and Happy Meals and nachos and this sort of stuff, and so their kids were taken away from the Christine family, and the Christines basically got a couple of guns and kidnapped their own kids back, and I believe the husband stuck a gun at the head of some social worker, and off they went down the road, and of course they got caught, and I imagine they're still in prison, but Edgar Steele defended them, and after that case he wrote an article called No Justice for the Politically Incorrect, and he mentioned a friend of his, a neighbor, who had come home to his farm in North Idaho, someplace wherever he lived, and he found a card from Child Protective Services under his door, and Edgar Steele was the only lawyer he knew, so he called Edgar Steele and asked what to do. And Steele said, look, I'm an officer of the court and all this sort of stuff. I can't technically be advising you this, but I have to tell you, you need to pack your truck, get those kids in the truck, and get out of the state tonight. Because it's like the Black Death in the Middle Ages. The only way to escape from Child Protective Services and keep your children once they get their claws into you is to flee the state. Get out of their jurisdiction. Because these people are monsters. They are like the ancient god Moloch. They will devour your children. The government wants to do that to everybody. The government wants absolute control over everybody's lives and everybody's kids.
Right. And it used to be that in order to get your children taken away from you, you had to be doing something seriously perverted or physically dangerous to them. And now it's things like a diet that somebody doesn't approve of, or that guy who got his kid taken away because he named him Adolf Hitler. I mean, never mind that niggers can name their kids lemon jello and all sorts of misspelled, horrible things that don't even make sense. Since when is it illegal to give your kid a certain name?
That's essentially what we are headed for. A nanny state, kind of like the state that exists in Britain right now, where you've got closed-circuit TVs on every corner watching you. They're interactive. In Britain right now, there is an entire subclass of thousands and thousands of semi-cops who are hired by the police and by various government agencies to do nothing except sit behind these monitors every day in a control room somewhere and watch the cameras and yell at people and order people around if they throw a candy bar wrapper or something down in a mall. And so you've got a whole bureaucracy, a whole class of people arising who do nothing but spy on other people. I think the record for a surveillance state is held by East Germany. The Stasi, the East German secret police, at one stage, they figure that one out of every three East Germans was a Stasi informer. They literally had it block by block, house by house. The stated objective of the Stasi was to have an informer in every single East German household. This is what we're headed for. This is what communism means. This is what liberalism means. And this is the way the left operates.
One thing that I remember from being in the university, it was after I got into a debate with a particular professor who tried telling the class that communism was a good thing, and I called him out on it. I asked him to explain how that was possibly a good thing in any way, shape, or form, and he got all angry with me. He's like, well, it's all about sharing responsibility and taking care of each other and make sure no one goes wanting. And after he went off on his spiel, I asked him, well, who decides this? Who decides what everyone needs and wants and what's good for everyone else? And he just said, the enlightened community, that's who decides it. That was his actual answer. So basically, people like him, who know so much better than everyone else, get to tell everyone else what to do. So needless to say, some jackass like him would definitely think that that's something.
Yeah. How old was this professor?
He was fairly old. He had tenure, and interestingly enough, professors with tenure, at the end of every semester, that's they would...
Tenure, by the way.
Tenure, okay. So, yeah, anyway, sorry. So basically, at the end of a semester, they would send you a survey, you know, how good you thought the professor was and whatnot. And it's interesting because that class got left out of the survey when they sent it to me.
What I was getting at was this guy actually old enough to have gone to or visited an actual communist country when the wall was still up?
You know, he was old enough to have been able to do it. I don't know whether he did or not. But the proof is in basically what he said. If he did visit one of those countries and still thinks that that's a good thing, that pretty much says it all right there.
One of the funniest of my Grandpa Simpson stories, I grew up back in the 60s, you know, we had SDS and whatnot in our high school, Students for a Democratic Society. Power to the people, man. Yeah. Gotta have a revolution, man. Far out. Drop out. Turn on, you know. The whole 60s thing. Anyway, Students for Democratic Society eventually became the Weathermen, and they blew themselves up in the townhouse in Greenwich, and they ran around in the streets of Chicago getting their heads cracked open by the police, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you know that whole shtick. Anyway, and this would have been about 1970, and our local chapter of the SDS at Chapel Hill High School somehow got hooked into one of these programs with the Vince Ramos Brigade. They were going to go down to Cuba for the summer and help the Cuban people bring in the sugarcane harvest. And they actually went down. There was one guy I knew named Walter Fowler, who was a raving, typical, gibbering student radical type, 16, 17 years old, and he knew it all. Well, of course, hell, so did I at that age. Anyway, so they go down to Cuba, and the Cuban government just shepherds them everywhere, won't let them out, controls absolutely what they see and what they hear, and they get a lot of lectures and a lot of, it's like a big tourist package holiday or something, but they're very careful not to let these kids get close to the actual people. When they went out to do their little labor service, cutting sugarcane in a few fields that had been set aside for them, just to make sure they didn't come into any contact with actual workers, Walter said the one thing that kind of impressed him most was the local people would sneak up to the fence at night, and they would want to buy the American kids clothes. They were offered all kinds of things just for a pair of jeans. I never did quite get what finally turned him around, but when Walter came back that fall, all that communist crap was beaten right out of him. Of course, I'm sure he probably ended up going on to become a yuppie, and he's probably making $100,000 a year now and all that sort of stuff and wallowing in greed and remembering his student radical days with nostalgia. But there is nothing like a close-up glimpse of communism in practice to cure people of communism in theory. All these liberal lefty professor types who think communism and Marxism is just the greatest thing since sliced bread, they've never actually had to live with it. They've never actually seen it. Well, actually, tenure is supposed to make college professors free to say and do and write whatever they want without fear of retaliation. Mm-hmm. That's how Kevin MacDonald survives.
Oh,
wow. He hasn't been fired from his university yet because he had tenure. There's moves afoot every year to try and strip MacDonald of his tenure so that he can be fired. Okay, let's go take a look at the news here. Here we go. Los Angeles County approves $1,000 fine for throwing football or frisbee on the beaches. You would think that frisbees and footballs would be kind of part of the beach scene down there. Okay, LA.
Can you throw a brick?
I don't know. When you head down to the beach for a little fun this summer, county officials want you to leave the pigskin at home. The Board of Supervisors this week agreed to raise fines for anyone who throws a football or frisbee on any beach in Los Angeles County. Okay.
Can you kick a football?
I don't know. If I can get this site to function, I can read the damn story. In passing the 37-page ordinance, not only are they banning frisbees and footballs on the beaches, but it takes them 37 pages to do it.
What is there to say?
I don't know. Well,
no football.
Even if you're going to do it, why does it take 37 pages? Okay, officials.
Finest.
Officials sought to outline responsibilities for law enforcement and other public agencies while also providing clarification on beachgoer activities that could potentially disrupt or even injure the public. You know what I bet this is about? Somebody on a beach in Los Angeles threw a football or a frisbee, conked some Jew in the head, the Jew yelled whiplash, and they're suing Los Angeles County for $200 million. I'll bet you anything this is something like that. According to Lucy Kim from the L.A. County Department of Beaches and Harbors, a first-time offender will have to pay a $100 fine. For a second offense, beachgoers will face a $200 fine. Three or more infractions within 1 year will result in a $500 fine. Maybe it's just a revenue-raising thing.
I was just going to say, aren't they nearly bankrupt? That's probably the reason why.
I bet you anything, they're probably going to have like scores of police and undercover officers down there on the beaches ready to jump on people who are throwing a frisbee or football and fine them immediately, just pick their pockets maybe. Anything raise revenue for the county. Well, that's what speed traps are. Speed traps are just basically there to raise revenue for these little towns. The updated rules now prohibit any person to cast, toss, throw, kick, or roll any object other than a beach ball or volleyball upon or over any beach between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Okay. Exceptions allow for ball throwing in pre-designated areas when a person obtains a permit.
Wow.
We have a permit to throw a ball here. Look, guys, I'm not making this up. I mean, I know our audience probably thinks I'm making this up, but okay.
How do we get a permit?
My name's Joe. I'm going to go down to the beach in Venice, and I want to get a permit for my balls. Anyway. However, during the winter off-season, the new rules will be relaxed. Officials warn that any activities that could potentially harm any person or property or near the beach should not be allowed during the... I bet you that's it. I bet you somebody threw a football and knocked some kike in the head with his football and the city got sued. And so now they're passing a law saying nobody can throw either that or they were throwing a frisbee to their dog and the dog came along and bit some Jew's leg instead or something. And I don't know. But
well, how can you still throw a volleyball? Wouldn't that also hurt somebody?
I think, okay, there's something about volleyball on California beaches, which is kind of like the state sport or something, especially women's volleyball. All the dirty old men go down there to watch or some such. I don't know.
Oh, no. I also read something.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, you got to scroll down.
Okay, right.
Your kids could also end up costing you big bucks. The ordinance prohibits digging any hole deeper than 18 inches. Who measures these?
Wow.
Do you have to get a permit for that? What if you want to dig a hole that's 20 inches?
Let me check this. I'm going to make sure this doesn't come from The Onion. The other day, I almost was going to quote this one story, but it turned out it was an Onion parody. No, this is not an Onion parody. This comes from the CBSLocal.com in Los Angeles. So, from now on the beach in Los Angeles, you cannot throw a football. As I read the ordinance, the 37-page ordinance, you can't throw anything but a beach ball or a volleyball, and you can't dig holes in the beach deeper than 18 inches.
Because you might be burying a football.
Concealed weapon there.
Sometimes you look at these things and you think, is this a joke? Have they literally lost their minds? Are they sitting down there in the Los Angeles City Council on drugs or what?
Okay, supposedly in a lot of major cities, police departments no longer have the time or the personnel to respond to burglary complaints or car break-ins. So how do they get the people to find time to just hang out on the beach all day and look for footballs and measure holes?
Well, if it's a revenue-raising thing, I assume that they'll have either special bureaucracy hired by the city to catch ball throwers and hole diggers, or they'll do it like an informer system. If you bust somebody for a first time throwing of a football, he pays a $200 fine. That'd be second offense. Okay. Say you bust him on a second offense, get $200. The informer gets $100. That's usually it's 50-50. The informer and the city split the take. And they say that there's many a true word said in jest. For all I know, it might actually be something like that. This might actually just be a desperate attempt by a bankrupt city in a bankrupt state to raise money by fining people who throw frisbees and footballs. They're getting that desperate. That could be what it is. Either that or, like I said, somebody sued the city. This is the way Americans react to problems like this. Anytime something bad happens, be it 9/11 or anything else, they go running to lock the barn door after the horse is gone. Okay. Oh, it's 74 degrees in Los Angeles. It'd be nice to be down there in a way, but wait a minute. No, we're off season now. Oh, you could go down to the beach in the 74 degrees now and you could throw a football. Okay. Cause it's
without a permit.
No, it's not between Memorial Day and Labor Day right now. This is February. So
they're just kind of warning us in advance.
Yeah, right.
That's good.
Okay, last day before Memorial Day, which I guess would be, what, May 30th? Everybody needs to go out there and get in their last ball and frisbee throwing.
And dig a hole.
Yeah, and hole digging until after Labor Day.
Yeah, let's leave that beach full of holes that somebody's going to have to come and fill up.
This is a request from Sally. She says it's one of her favorites. It's Final War, Tales of Honor.
As a brave and loyal man, he gave his life for his village because he loved his land. From that night of May 10th in 1941, he boarded an enemy once and for his mission has just begun. Destination Scotland, the Duke of Hamilton, he must see. For what was to evolve from this, a mystery of peace? City Hall, Rome, Rudolph, S, legacy in the dark. Your courage and your honor keeps us marching strong.
Well, just now we were talking and the subject of Japanese internment during the war came up, and I won't repeat this long spritz I was given about how it was really a reasonable precaution, but the niggers actually base their claim for so-called reparations for slavery on the fact that the U.S. government did pay the Japanese who were interned during World War II reparations to the tune of something like $20,000 each, and that's the official foundation that niggers use for their demand for reparations for slavery. But there's a very crucial difference there. The money in that case of the Japanese was paid to the people who actually were interned. And so I'm actually all in favor of reparations for the cruelty of slavery. I say we should give $10 million to every former slave that we can find. But beyond that, I mean, it's just ridiculous to pay this kind of reparation for something that happened 150 years ago in which modern white people simply weren't involved in at all.
I would gladly pay reparations for every slave that I ever owned.
Be a little bit hard to find slaves nowadays, wouldn't it?
Every single piece of obsolete farm equipment.
Well, that's what niggers are, basically, is obsolete farm equipment. The black man did not contribute anything to this country that couldn't have been done twice as good and at half the expense by a good strong horse. And basically, once the cotton picker and the cotton gin were invented in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the black man became obsolete. Eventually, we'll have robots or trained chimps or something to pick our fruit, and Mexicans will be obsolete. Well, last major job I worked, we had this mulatto girl named Naima. And she was pretty clearly about half and half. And somehow she was moaning in the smoke hole about reparations and claiming that since she was half white and half black, how is she going to get a reparations? And I just, well, it's just simple, Naima. Your white half writes a check to your black half.
Or your black half can hold the white half at gunpoint.
Yeah, right. Black half can mug the white half.
So this is Black History Month, and we should be thinking about all of the contributions that our dark brethren have given our nation.
I was going to try and work up a dry ice for that. I couldn't really think of anything offhand, so I won't try to do one spontaneously, but...
No one likes it.
Okay, well, there is that as well.
I actually think you're funny.
You know, I've done an Aryan history, and I've done a Jewish history. The Jewish History series has about like 12 emails in it, 12 articles. Aryan History has 56. I can, of course, add some more. Can add almost an infinite number to both. But you really, when you think about it, you can't do much about black history because really, for real, outside political correctness, there isn't any.
Well, I don't know. Modern day blacks contribute quite a lot in my mind. For one example, they act as traffic control. They bebop across busy streets and block every damn buddy from passing them.
In Australia, they call them boongs. You know, the Ebos there are very black and not actually niggers as we understand the terms. Australian Ebos are probably the most primitive people in the world. I mean, they make Africans look sophisticated.
Is that possible?
It is. I don't know if you've ever seen any Ebos. I mean, as far as the appearance, I mean, you swear to God, these creatures are definitely on a lower phase of evolution, but they call them boongs because out in the outback, of course, your Land Rover or your Jeep or your truck or whatever always has a thing in front of it, kind of like a big sort of bumper called a rhubarb. Or kangaroo bar, because as when you're, you know, roaring down the roads in the outback there, kangaroos and wallabies and whatnot jump out in front of your vehicle, and you actually have to have this roo bar on there, or it'd be like running into a deer here. You'd be running into a 200-pound kangaroo. So, supposedly, when you hit an Ebo with your roo bar and send him flying off into the bush, the noise he makes is boong. That's why they call them boongs. I'm not making that... They call us white motherfucker, honka ofe motherfucker. Not much imagination there. I have counted over 100 words in the English language for nigger.
So these Abos, I guess if one ever was in America, you couldn't call him an African-American. You'd have to call him a nigger because they don't come from Africa.
Actually, technically, he would be an Australo-American. They call them Abos or Aboriginals in Australia. In Canada, the official term for Indians is Aboriginals, which is bizarre, which I suppose makes a little bit more sense than Native Americans down here. But again, the sheer creative brilliance of our minds in thinking up humorous names and nicknames for these creatures is like in Africa, we had Kaffirs, we had Munts, which comes from Muntu, we had Hoots, which is Afrikaans. We called them oxygen wasters. I'm not kidding. We call them, let's see, a few people call them slopes. I think they picked that up from Vietnam. But, of course, in America, we got niggers, we got porch monkeys, we got jigaboos, we got coons.
Spear chucker.
Yeah, spear chuckers.
Monkoid.
Monkoid. Well, now, that is my contribution to the English language.
Yes.
I made that up when I was with Cale and the NSWPP in the 1970s. I started using it on the white power recorded message we had. And one day I was walking down the street in Arlington. I heard a couple of white kids going by and they were talking. I can't remember the exact context, but one of them used the word monkoid. So I knew I was being listened to. And I think it's kind of crept into the language.
You better copyright that.
Let's see, what else do we call niggers?
I think we could make a lot of money if we manufactured roo bars for Priuses and sold them to people here in Seattle.
It's gotten worse. I mean, I lived in Seattle about 17 years ago from 1994 and 1995. I lived over on the east side. One of the things I liked about it is while there were gooks out the wazoo over there 15, 16 years ago, but you never saw anywhere near the number of niggers you see in Seattle. And it's a lot of it is an African migration. And by the way, I am not claiming that the Northwest is all white. I admit, yes, it has gotten worse since I was here the first time, but what we do maintain is that the Northwest is still, outside of the cities, the nicest place left in the country to live. It will be the last part of the continent that actually resembles anything like the America we're used to, and as bad as things may be getting here in the cities, it's infinitely worse anywhere else. Everyone who comes into the Northwest from outside, anywhere, East Coast, Texas, Florida, California, Midwest, they all say that it is infinitely better racially here. Here you can actually pull up at like a fast food restaurant or a convenience store and find a white person behind the counter. That amazes people.
I remember early on when I first found the Northwest Front and started corresponding with people, they all wanted to know, do you have the white neighborhood set up yet? And some of this was people on the internet or people who would write to us for information. Some of it was from prisoners. The common theme was, is it all ready yet or do I have to do anything when I get there? And I think I always knew from the very beginning, no, this is not an all-white area. The idea is we're going to make it that way. And we're looking for other people who want to be a part of making this what it will be.
Yeah, that's one of our big migration problems, if I can get a little bit serious here. Nobody wants to go first. Nobody wants to do the heavy lifting. Nobody wants to weave the safety net for the others to come. I get a lot of emails from prospective migrants, and in various ways they say, well, get back with me, Harold, when you've got something set up, when you can give us a job or give us housing, or just basically let us know when the cakes and ale are set out and we'll sashay on in and honor you with our presence. We have to revive that genuine pioneer spirit. Our ancestors came to this land originally in wagons pulled by oxen or mules, and there was nobody here waiting for them at all, other than hostile Indians. They just put everything they owned in those wagons, and they walked across the plains to get here. Which, even today, when you're driving here from the East Coast and you're going across those plains in Nebraska and Wyoming and Montana, places like that, you are stunned and awed by the strength and the character and the will of our ancestors who made that trip on foot. We can't even get people to come here down interstate highways staying in Motel 6s at night. I can't believe how we've degenerated and how weak and flaccid the white race has become.
The sad thing is, though, if they just move here, if they're outside the cities, most of the time their neighborhood is majority white.
I have tried to explain this time and time again. Oh, Harold, we can't come to the Northwest. It's full of liberals. And, oh, I saw a street picture in Seattle. I saw a nigger. Booga, 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 can't have that. And so outside these two or three huge cities, Seattle, Portland, Spokane to some extent, Eugene, because it's got the University of Oregon down there, and just outside those three or four urban areas, the hinterland, if you want to call it that, of the Northwest is still 99% white, and it's a lovely place to live, and it's a place where you can raise a family. And then, by the way, even those who come to our Puget Sound area, primary settlement area, we don't really advocate that you settle in the middle of Seattle, although some people do. They have to because of work. We kind of had to set up a PSA here because there are a lot of people who, quite frankly, simply have to have an urban area because their trade or their craft or whatever work they're going to be doing requires the economic infrastructure of a city. Now, if you've got your own skill, if you can do anything from fix cars, fix computers, cut hair, do anything, if you can afford to set up your own business or in some way get a paycheck that does not involve physical proximity to a city and you get out in some of these smaller towns, even in the suburban rings around Portland and Seattle, there are lots of suburbs of Seattle, for example, that are still majority white and still quite livable. So it's not like we're asking you to settle in the middle of downtown Los Angeles.
Downtown Seattle itself is actually pretty white, except for a few areas like 3rd Avenue around Pike and Pine Street. So it's a lot more tolerable than people might think.
I first came, it was, like I say, not that many niggers at all. My first weekend in Seattle, it was on a Sunday morning. I took the bus down to Pioneer Square because I'd heard that it was a historic area. This was 94, and it was pretty sleazy, but it wasn't nigger sleazy. It was a bunch of white winos and homeless down there, a lot of them. I wanted to yell, the scoops are coming, the scoops are coming. I don't know if you guys ever saw that movie Soylent Green, but the downtown area that I go into, like I say, you see a fair number of niggers, but a lot of them are Africans, especially cab drivers. There's a cab stand down there near where I pass by regularly, and it's one of those cases where Africans seem to have taken over the taxi cab driving industry. God knows how some nomad from Ethiopia or Somalia can find his way around Seattle, but apparently they do. Other than that, Seattle itself is still officially 90-some-odd percent white, and that's the official statistics. So it's not like, say, Houston or Philadelphia or Miami or New York City. We had one guy who refused to come to the Northwest finally. He said, no, I'm going to stand and fight here. He was talking about staying in Detroit, for God's sake.
How's that fight going?
I don't know, but I mean, why? I just don't get why anyone would voluntarily live in a place like Detroit when he could come here.
No, I heard in Detroit they're selling homes for as little as a dollar, and that's still not convincing enough for me to move there.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of them, too. They're in bad nigger neighborhoods, crack dealers on the corner, bullet holes in the door. These little shotgun-type houses, they weren't worth much to begin with, but yeah, they're being seized for taxes by the city or the county because they've been abandoned. If anybody ever did know who owned them, that's forgotten. The city records have probably been eaten by rats or something right now, and they can't even find who owns a place. Or they, well, this guy owned this house in 1969, and that's the last record we have, and who knows where he is. So the city's just taken over houses, and yeah, you can buy a house for a dollar if you want to live in the middle of Niggertown, Detroit, with all the crack addicts and the general scum.
I could have met Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
So really, the list of reasons people have of not to come here, they all tend to be the same thing. There's, well, the weather and certain geographical features like volcanoes are going to just blow up and kill everyone. And there's the wonderful job that you have in Chicago that you just can't do anywhere else in the whole world. It has to be Chicago or you and your whole family will die. And then there's your wife who probably won't let you. And then I think the newest reason I've heard is the presence of me specifically in the Northwest. Somebody needs to come up with a new reason not to come here because those just aren't good enough.
Well, they're scared of you. Scared you're going to beat them up.
I will.
But basically, white people are excellent at finding excuses to do nothing. Fine, reasonable, rational explanations as to why the very best thing to be done is nothing. We know what we want to do. We know that we're not going to come here to the Northwest because basically we're chicken shit. We're too lazy. We're scared. It would involve risk and inconvenience. It would cut into our TV time. It would cut into our computer time. The little woman would give us all kinds of hell and rant and rave at us, maybe threaten to leave and take the kids and all that sort of stuff. Okay, but at least be honest about it. I have some people on the list who more or less admit to me, Harold, look, I'll do what I can from here, but I ain't coming because I ain't got the stones for it. Or I ain't coming because my wife would simply walk out the door and take the kids and you know, I can't handle that. Okay, fine. I'm disappointed, but I can see where these people are coming from. The ones that get me are the ones that make up the stupid excuses or the ones that next year, Harold. I swear I'll be up there next year. I just got to do this one more thing right here in Cincinnati or Atlanta or Milwaukee, wherever I am. I just got to take care of this one more thing and I'll be up there next year. I mean, I've got guys that have been doing this for 10 years.
And then there's that whole mentality that says, well, that's not fair. Why can't we do it where I live?
Well, if it was possible to do it where they live, I would certainly be open to the idea, but it isn't. Now, my personal opinion is that we lost the last chance we had to take back the entire country in 1958 when Eisenhower ordered those troops into Little Rock and we didn't do anything. That was the point where the Confederate States of America should have been re-declared officially and we should have been led into battle against the Union once again by the same people who led us before, the governors, the state legislators, the doctors, the lawyers, the professionals, the rich businessmen, the clergymen, our natural ruling class in the South, if you want to call it that. They were the ones who led us in 1861, but they'd all sold out to the Chamber of Commerce and color TV and air conditioning by 1958. And so the result is we were left with some very poor, very ignorant, sincere, but just not very bright guys like the Ku Klux Klan in the UKA. And they organized what resistance they could, but That was one of the reasons that the resistance against so-called civil rights in the South failed in the 60s, because we had a few people who were good sergeant majors, but no generals. But that was the last chance we had to take back this entire country. The demographic destruction and degeneration and decay of this country since then has simply gone too far. All we can do now is hope to save a segment of it.
So for those of you who say, well, why can't we do it where I live so I don't have to get out of bed and I don't have to move where I got the 7-Eleven close by and everything? Well, okay, let's do it where you live. Get Harold's novels. You know, those of you who know how to read, read them and do it. Form your own NVA and, hey, maybe I'll even come join you. But I don't ever see you actually doing it. Mm.
Well, at one stage, some of you know, before I was into the Northwest thing, I was briefly involved with a group called the Confederate National Congress. I wrote a Southern Nationalist treatise in 1989, I think it was, called The South Shall Rise Again. It was a sort of Confederate version of the Northwest thing. And I, for various reasons, abandoned that, largely because I thought Southern Nationalism was too sectarian. I wanted a homeland for all white people the world over. But I'll be honest, if some of these so-called neo-Confederate outfits like the League of the South or the CVA or anything like that in the South were actually to begin physically resisting once again, seriously attempting to reestablish the Confederacy, I'd be back there myself, old and useless as I am. But it's not going to happen. These people say, well, I'm going to stand and fight, Harold. Nobody is standing and fighting anywhere.
So since nobody's fighting anywhere, why doesn't everybody come here and we can all fight together?
If nothing else, we can all stand together and hold hands and sing Kumbaya. There are a lot of old hippies here, and they're really nice people, I swear.
Far out, man. Oh, racism. Far out, man.
Oh, man, I hate niggers.
Actually, I knew some pothead types back in the day who did hate niggers, because basically because niggers were always burning them on drug deals. I mean, one of the things I learned in college and high school, that one of the reasons that certain white girls were always hanging around niggers was because niggers had the best drugs. But the trouble is they didn't, and sometimes their drugs got you in trouble because their grass was mostly oregano and you lit up a joint, it smelled like a pizza parlor. Or else the grass was laced with various, what was that chemical stuff that the government used to spray on it to try and kill people?
Zyklon B?
No. I think they eventually stopped doing it because they killed a bunch of hippy-dippy types. But at one stage, this was in the 70s, the government was actually using crop dusters to spray marijuana crops with some kind of poisonous substance. And so when they harvested the grass and cut it up into the lids and rolled the joints and everything like that, they supposedly was just going to make the customers sick, but some of them dropped dead anyway, so they quietly deep-sixed that program. That's another little bit of history that just quietly went down the memory hole, like the swine flu shots and stuff like that. I have totally, completely forgotten what I was rambling about.
Because he's got that short-term memory loss. You know, I'm not surprised that after my anti-pot smoking thing I put on, there were a bunch of comments saying basically what I said they would all say, justifying their marijuana use. Like, I don't care. Do what you do, but stop whining about it. It's like all those people who whine and cry because, oh, well, when you're 18, you can go kill people for the country, but you can't even sit down and have a beer. That just makes me wish the drinking age was 22, out of pure spite.
Actually, I believe, now, when I was in the Army myself, a lot of the bases were in states where the legal drinking age was 21, and you could actually, if you were a serving member of the military, if you were 19 or whatever, you could get beer and booze and whatnot on the base in the PX or in the NCO's mess or the club or whatever. I don't know if it's the same, but I don't know if they're totally like that anymore.
Well, when I was in another racial organization, I requested that all members under 21 not drink alcohol while they were at our functions, not because I really care what they do, but because I wanted to see just how important is this to you. Will you decide not to serve the cause if you can't do everything that you like to do?
Well, it's also a good idea because if you have a meeting in your, and by the way, guys, this is serious. I talk about General Order Number 10 of the NVA in my books, but I really am very, very strongly in favor of the Northwest Front itself having completely non-alcoholic meetings. One reason being something that one of our, I'll adhere to the first taboo and I won't name him, but this one guy that used to hold a lot of these skinhead rock concerts almost got in a lot of trouble. This, if you have rock concert or a meeting or a barbecue or anything like that, and you've got people under 21 who are drinking, then the cops can swoop in. And all of a sudden, if it's your party, if it's on your land, or if it can be any way connected with you, you are in trouble for 6 or 7 counts of contributing to the delinquency of a minor or whatever it is, and you can get your ass sued. That's the same reason I had a problem when I was with the Klan back in the 90s. I refuse to put my name on parade permits or applications because some of my fellow Klansmen refused to discourage or shoo away a bunch of kids that wanted to come along on our street activities. And that's all it's going to take is one kid getting conked in the head with a bottle or a brick, and he or she is underage, and your name's on that permit, then your ass is grass legally. So this is one reason why if you must have drinking or alcohol at any kind of racial political function, NF or any other kind, do not allow under 21s to drink, because the system will use it as a handle to destroy your group and make you legally liable for anything that happens, especially if there's an automobile accident. Well, I haven't gone medieval on your ass for a while. This is one of the Top of the Pops from back in the days of the Crusades, and the group is called Portcullis. Okay, once again, I'm running way long this week. It's those panel discussions. I actually save them on my hard drive several hours at a time, and I kind of carve off slices to use every week as if they were a big cheesecake or a ham that one keeps in the fridge. Now, sometimes I forget what we actually said, and I get so interested in it that I run segments which are maybe a little longer than I should. I was going to wind up this week's show with a personal commentary on what I call the T-shirt youth, but that's going to have to wait until next week. I'm now up until almost an hour and 17 minutes, and I have to cut this short because if I go over an hour and 20 minutes, I can't burn the show onto a CD, and there are some people who don't own computers who need to keep up with what's going on here. So our time is up, and that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha and Bon. Freedom.
Still is beating heart in manhood's morning noon. Who could follow in their footsteps at the rising of the moon? At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon. Who would follow in their footsteps at